She's Not There, Rod, it's a classic. Were you under any sort of pressure to write that, given what you've told us about how it came about, and you could have used perhaps Summertime, but is that something you had up your sleeve, or did you literally go away and compose it?
I went away and composed it, and but the thing is, I'm fond of saying that you only have the sort of arrogance and naivety of being 18 years old once, and I thought that, you know, I didn't know anything about any of the things that could go wrong. I had no experience of any of the pitfalls or you know, I thought that it went without saying that the sound that we would get in the studio would be brilliant, that Colin would sing the song beautifully, that it would be exciting and would come off beautifully and would be a hit. I just expected that. I mean, I was very excited when it happened, but I sort of expected it because I couldn't see any other scenario. I was just so innocent. You know, and then, of course, I was soon disillusioned with all that. But in some ways, I expected that to happen. And that was the sort of strength of doing it at the time because I had total confidence in what I was doing, even though I'd only ever written one song before. In fact, two songs, actually. I'd written one song that we recorded on our first album called It's All Right With Me, or on our first EP. And we used to do that on stage, and it used to go down very well, actually. And there was one song a year before that I'd written for a local group that Jim Rodford, my cousin, was playing in called the Blue Tones. And I thought that I'd never hear that again, but Jim came up last year with a tape of that, and it's very Beatly. Very sort of early Beatly, but it sounds really good.
Well, when you wrote She's Not There, I mean, would you say anything in particular influenced you in terms of, you've already mentioned sort of Elvis and, you know, some of the artists you were exposed to in the early 60s, but was there anything going on when you were composing it in terms of any reference points, or would you say that wasn't really the case?
Well, I thought I was just writing a rock song, and I was going to start from square one. I thought, okay, I need a starting point lyrically, and I was playing my old blues albums. But you know, when I say old blues albums, I mean some of the old artists like John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters and whatever. And there was a John Lee Hooker track called No One Told Me. Now, it's absolutely nothing like anything in She's Not There, but it just started sort of, no one told me, it just started like that, and I thought, well, no one told me, I quite like that, and I just started developing a little story from those words, and wrote the melody of the opening verse around a little bluesy sort of scale, as you know, right from the beginning of the song, just started at the beginning. The thing that I had in my head was to, there was a little chord sequence that I liked, which was just, to be a little bit technical, was an A minor seventh to a D major chord, and I quite liked that. And I'd heard it on a couple of, I think there was a Betty Everett song, You're No Good, that used that, and I quite liked it. And I thought, I must use that little chord sequence somewhere. And so I incorporated that into the verse. The idea of, these are musical things again, in the second section of the song, It's Too Late to Say You're Sorry, I had the idea of, I really liked when you play chords, but the bass didn't play the root of the chord, it played a different interval within the chord. And so I involved that, and that became the sort of transition passage to the third section of the song. And my idea of that was just to start with this little bluesy phrase, have a transition passage, and then just build it up to an absolute climax, and then come back down again. And the idea of that third section of the song, I thought, I'll get Colin, who I knew had a really good range, to hit a pretty high note, and just really almost a one-note melody on, you know, let me tell you about the way she looks, and change the chords around that one note, just to build intensity, really. And they were the ideas that were flowing through the song. And I wrote the song, and I wanted to play a little jazzy thing in the middle, although I didn't think of it as jazz. I just thought of it as, because even at that time, we improvised a lot. And, you know, years later, I saw Pat Metheny play, and it was as he was just becoming well-known. And there was this quite prominent jazz bass player called Jeff Berlin, who was a friend of John Heisman's, who'd never heard of me, and no reason why he should. And he introduced me to Pat Metheny. And he was completely amazed because Pat turned round to me and said, "Rod Argent, you wrote She's Not There. That's the song that made me feel that I had a way ahead doing what I wanted to do." And he said, all that lovely modal stuff. And I thought, there's no modal stuff in it. But then when I went back and played those first chords, I realised that because I'd listened to so much Miles Davis, without even thinking about it, I played a little modal sequence over the verse that fitted the chords. And so there were all these little indirect things that came into the mix of the song, really, and really helped, I think.
Fantastic. And of course, I mean, perhaps the best known alternate version was Santana.
I loved it.
And it was pretty damn authentic, wasn't it?
I absolutely loved it. You know, Santana were one of my favourite groups in the 60s, and then they went for quite a long fallow period without actually having a hit single. And then it was She's Not There that got them out of that fallow period, and I was so knocked out that that was the case. I loved their version of it. You know, I loved the sort of the concentration on the you know, there were some Latin tendencies in the song anyway, but they you know, concentrate on that, obviously, because that's what they do. Very exciting, very true to the song, the spirit of the song. I loved it.
Now let's go back to the late 60s, because Odyssey and Oracle we mentioned in the context of those 40th anniversary gigs, but that was the album released 1968, and as I understand it, the band had pretty much split up after, or maybe even before that was released. What was the reason for that, Rod, at that time?
Well, my memory was that it was in the air that the band might split, and the reasons for that were pretty much financial, and it was because in one way, we were extremely lucky because we had publishers who were as honest as the day is long. So from a writing point of view, Chris White and I, who were the writers in the band, got paid a very decent income, because we later found out, years later, we found out that most times we had hits around the world, even though the world was a much bigger place in those days, and you didn't always know that in those days. I mean, now you know everything immediately, but it wasn't the case then. So the income that I was getting and that Chris White was getting was pretty good, always. For the other guys, because we were so much based in the UK, and the UK was the one country in the world where we only ever had one hit, apart from Germany, strangely, we never really did very well in Germany, but almost everywhere else in the world, we had a lot of hits. And because we were then so much based in the UK, and only ever had really She's Not There as a hit in the UK, the money for the gigs had really fallen off a lot. And it got to the point where Paul Atkinson, the guitarist, first of all said, "Look, I'm married now. You know, I'm finding it hard to support my family. I've got to move on. I've got to do something else." And then at that point, Colin sort of concurred with that, because he was very short of money. And that was the driving force, I believe, in the breakup being in the air. But Chris and I very strongly wanted to produce an album ourselves with our own ideas on it, because we'd felt that a lot of the singles we'd been recently making had not been well produced. Because we had a very old school producer, and he did a beautiful job on She's Not There, but then instead of looking at that and saying, let's just take each song as it stands and get the most out of it, he would say, well, what made She's Not There a hit? Well, it was Colin's breathy vocals, so he would concentrate everything on the sort of breathiness of the vocal rather than just bringing out whatever was in the song. And more and more, we were making demos that we thought were great, and then the final production was falling down. So that was one reason why we wanted to really make the album and have some of our own ideas on the album. And we went into... And to be very fair to Ken, our producer, he helped us get a deal. Well, at least we got a deal with CBS Records, but he helped us get Abbey Road, which was extremely unusual for a non-EMI act at the time. And we recorded and went into Abbey Road just after, I think virtually as the Beatles were walking out, having just finished Sgt. Pepper, we were walking in and starting Odyssey and Oracle. So it was a pretty magical time. Just one other thing to say there, and that is that while we had very honest publishers, we were very ripped off from the live side of things. And for instance, one thing that I know really broke Colin's spirit was the fact that we'd gone over to play in the Philippines, and we were playing to 40,000 people a night for 10-night residency, and we got paid £80 a night between us, because we had absolutely no idea we meant anything at all over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that pretty much broke Colin's spirit, actually. That was another reason why he wanted to get out.